Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman. Delighted to have you here, Luca, talking about living complexity. Got a wonderful book on complexity that we're going to walk through today. But before we go through your book, how did you even get interested in complexity in the first place? What attracted you to it?
Well, it was between 2003, 2004. At that time, it has been a while that I was practicing extreme programming and I was into Agile, and myself and many other teams start to have a consistent sequence of successes. And so we start to wonder, but while this is working, there must be something more than the manifesto to explain why this is working. And we were looking for deeper foundation. And at that time, Joseph Perlin presented in a keynote complexity science as a way to explain why Agile works and where it's needed. And that was my introduction to complexity.
When was that roughly, Luca?
End of 2003, beginning of 2004. It was at the Italian Agile Day, the first Italian Agile Day, and Joseph Perlin was giving a keynote, starting a journey that lasted many years for me.
Yeah, indeed. When I talk to executives, the first thing I talk to them about is complexity, believe it or not, before I talk about anything about product or agility and that kind of stuff, because it's kind of the reason why all this kind of cool stuff is needed, really, isn't it?
Yes, I find it to explain why it works and where we need it. So,
yeah. I call it like a compass. As long as somebody can read the compass and knows what to do, we should be good to go. And in your book, you talk about non-human and human complexity. But before we get into that, you have quite an interesting work career that kind of led you through complexity as well, I believe you were in ThoughtWorks for a while. You worked with an F1 team, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I joined the Ferrari Formula One racing team. And it was quite interesting for me for many reasons. One reason, it was my first experience of the human side of complexity. So think about a car. A Formula One car is made up of 10,000 of parts created by different departments. And all the teams try to have every single part made perfectly, work perfectly, perfect performance. But the magic that put top teams ahead and make them win the championship is how all those parts come together. And you know, it means that the people from different departments need to solve together complex problems, trade-offs, and figure out creative solutions that involve different background, different parts, and find the magic that make them win. And I'm not talking only about the technical aspects of bringing all these parts together, but the social and human aspect on top of that. Think about agreement, think about consensus, think about understanding, and think about politics, power, and belief.
And egos, I guess, be a lot of kind of strong characters in a setup like that, I'd imagine. Quite a fast pace in more ways than one, right?
That's right. And when I joined the Ferrari Formula One, it was a pretty flat organization, at least compared to other times. And so it was possible for me to interact with a lot of different departments, and everyone that had a good idea could speak up. But you see, a place where everyone can help, where they see they can help, they can interact with others. You see how this can create a social complexity that you have to tackle, but at the same time is needed to make the best of this collective intelligence that you have available there.
How long were you there, Luca, with Ferrari? How long did I go on for?
a few years. When I arrived, Barrichello was leaving, Massa was starting. So I worked with Massa and Schumacher, Ross Brawn and Jean Todt. A few years later, Schumacher left the team. We had the Raikkonen. We won a championship with the Raikkonen against McLaren. And then I left just before Alonso was joining the team. So I worked preparing the season for Alonso. And then I left Ferrari and I moved abroad.
And what was your role in Ferrari? What, well, maybe you had a few roles during that time, but what would have been your biggest role, I guess?
Well, the reason why I joined Ferrari, or what gave me the opportunity, was my interest in agile software development. So software at that time in Formula One was a bigger competitive advantage, and I was using modern techniques such as extreme programming and other agile practices. And I joined the team to help them advance the adoption of agile practices, but most of all, delivering features to create a competitive advantage for the team. I remember my boss at the time, Pier Giorgio Grossi, told me, I would like you to help me make the team deliver value more quickly and more safely at the same time. And isn't that an interesting paradox, talking about complexity?
Absolutely. Trying to keep in control at pace while still adapting to what's going on. And I'd imagine as well that in a Grand Prix scenario, they're trying to tune the car all year. They're trying to get it to really have optimal performance. Every year, they kind of change the rules a little bit, so they can't just use the car from last year. They kind of have to make lots of design changes, as far as I remember. And so you're kind of almost chasing the car during the Grand Prix season with your software updates. So how frequently were the software updates? Like, were you kind of releasing like every week or something like that? Or how frequently was it?
Well, every race, there were new features released for the race. At the time, there were also frequent test events. So new features were released also at the test event. So we were going to release new features between half a week to 1 week and a half, 2 weeks. We had a deadline when the race started. You cannot ask your customer to wait for the software release.
Yeah, how did you manage that? Because I often work with people saying, well, we really don't know how long it's going to take. And you can use probabilistic forecasts, but that's still like smoke and mirrors, I should say. How did you manage that? Like, say, managing their expectations with when stuff would be done and stuff like that?
At the time, the idea came from extreme programming, that is about don't change the heartbeat of your work, change the scope and work in incremental ways so that your code base and your product is only in a green state. And with the green state, I mean potentially releasable. Yeah. So you can always do the best with the time that you have. And as software developers, we were constantly thinking about what was the important bit that we could work on, even incrementally. So then no matter when the deadline comes, we will be able to deliver the most valuable things that we could do with the given time.
I'm guessing you were working with a great team. I'm guessing it's one of those teams that you remember as a great team. Would I be right?
That is right. But I want to say this. Yes, people were great, great teammates. But don't underestimate the professionality and practices that we were using for real. Not talking about that, but doing it for real.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the difference. Think about, let's go again at the beginning when Pier Giorgio Grossi told me we want to go faster and safer at the same time. Mm. That's not about a hero culture. That's not about a genius, especially when software development is moving from an individual sport to a team sport. It's about how we work together, technical practices that we use. And one of the elements is reversibility, the ability to go fast, but also push the brake and roll back. So our technical practices, our technical excellence, our approach to delivery allow us to do those things. Let me mention, for example, the ability to roll back in real time a feature with the one click, regardless if the feature is backward compatible or not. So when something goes wrong, you have an automatic remediation plan that allow you to go back to a safe state, even during a race. Or think about pair programming, the ability to spot any mistakes because you have two pairs of eyes looking at the same code, or automated testing, spending time and investing time to write code to test your code. I almost risk my job because we start doing that as new team members with the very VIP customers. And we told them, this is going to take more or less this time, and we will automate the test. And they were looking at us like if we were crazy. Writing code is already time expensive, and you want to write twice the code, almost to write test. Yeah. That's crazy. Mm. But we start to do that. Agile wasn't so famous at the time, so there was no chit chat, PowerPoint, and using names like Agile and stuff to justify yourself. The only thing that we could do is to show that through our testing, automated testing, we were spotting mistakes in the race simulation strategy that they didn't spot before. And we showed them that we were able to add the new feature and evolve the code faster because the existing test allow us to make big changes to the code without breaking what was already working.
And I'm guessing if you're making changes during the race, I'm guessing you might have managed that with feature flags or something, kind of turning a feature on and off, because deploying would be quite dangerous while the car was moving. Yeah.
Well, the different elements, we didn't release a software inside the car. There is a lot of software that ran on the pit wall and outside the car.
Yeah.
At the time, most of the software was running on server or personal computers at the race. So it was still possible to quickly deploy and do very quick rollback of the software. During the development, we were using what nowadays we call feature flag in order to allow us to gradually release a software feature that were ready for production. And people often talk that a feature flag is a way to branch in your code without branching in the source code repository. And this gives you more flexibility and even more give you, make it easier to roll back. So allow you what I call reversibility. And non-reversibility is one of the primary driver of complexity. In XP 2004, a professor from economics spoke about this in studies related to, I think, not software development, but how non-reversibility is one of the primary drivers for complexity.
Very good. So I probably one of your great teams. If you were to kind of count, looking back over your career, the number of great teams you worked with, honestly, what kind of number are we talking about? Ballpark? You're looking at like less than 5, less than 10, less than 20?
Less than five. I could count them in a hand. Yeah. And I don't think this had to do with the quality of the team. There are a lot of things that need to come together to make a great team. And some of those things are the context, the timing, and having a chance to succeed. In Formula One, for example, if you look at Formula One team, try to argue about the external regulation of the championship. Mm-hmm. Oh, they behave like children when they do that. But when you have a sporting regulation that dictated every race and the rules are clear, the constraints are clear inside those constraints, they show an incredible ability. So you need also an environment and the context that allow the team to be great.
Yeah, and sometimes we have a feeling when we're with the team that they're great, but it's really, I can speak for myself, I guess I can't speak for you, but it's kind of more afterwards. You probably know at the time that it really is a great team, but then it's afterwards that you really realize, it really sinks in, wow, that was a great team. And and when I met Heidi Helfand, we were talking about her book Dynamic Reteaming, she kind of made the same admission as well, and more or less, and she was saying that But she went further. She was saying that if you have a great team, don't mess with it. Like, because if you split a great team, you end up with two mediocre teams, basically. So let the new people, you know, start a new team. And it might be good actually for cognitive diversity as well, because, you know, maybe they can not get so stuck in the kind of clannish, cliquish thinking that can happen sometimes in teams. So we're getting into the nub of your book, actually, because at the start of your book, Living Complexity, which you wrote in 2022, I believe, I'm not sure if there was earlier versions back to 2020 as well, but basically you talk about human complexity, which is kind of what we're touching on here. So how would you describe human complexity to people?
Well, think about this. There are many different types of complexity. People normally talk about complexity science. People sometimes even talk about complexity sciences, because human complexity was born inside many different scientific fields. I use the term human complexity to focus on human complex systems, where people are the primary agent in the system. Think about this. We could have a lot of different complex systems, weather systems, biological complex system, or flocks, animals. But humans are those systems that we are more interested on, like teams, department, and organization.
And I noticed as well in the book, when you broke it down a little bit, you talked about identity, our roles, and you talked about intentionality, about doing things intelligence, diversity and dissent as well, so we don't have groupthink. And then there were some kind of side points you made about the importance of storytelling and the importance of a network. You gave a kind of one-liner from Stanley McChrystal about you need a network to fight a network kind of thing. So can you tell us a little bit more about a few of those points, Luca? Identity, intentionality, intelligence, diversity.
Well, there is when we look at a mathematical complex system, biological, physical, like in physics, or when we look at natural complex system and instead the human complex system, there are some elements that make us human being very different as agents compared to the other. In many other non-human complex system, we tend to treat each agent as if they are all the same. A lot of agents that are equal to each other, replaceable. Instead, when we look at people in a team, in a department, in an organization, we are all different. We are unique. We have our own identity that can change over time, but I will never become John and you will never become Luca. And you may be very happy about that, but that's life. And if we are in a team, we cannot be replaced one with the other thinking that we'll be identical. No, we are different. And then we are self-conscious. We know what we want to do and what we feel, what we fear, the joy and the pain. We also sometimes act with the free will, sometimes driven by our values, our purpose, sometimes driven by rationality, sometimes driven by emotion, impulsivity, and complete irrationality, but we cannot be controlled. And we have the ability to create and share knowledge socially with others. And those elements make us special and makes a human complex system very special compared to the others.
Yeah, and you made a point in the book as well about a self-organizing team being a contradiction in terms. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and why that's an expression that you think is maybe a bit misinformed?
Well, a team alone is not self-organizing. It doesn't exist in the vacuum. There is an environment around the team, and this is kind of connected to the point that the team, to be a great team, need also an environment and the context where they can thrive. So it's really a complex human system, where the environment counts too, who is inside the team and who is outside, where are the boundaries and the barriers, what are the constraints, who they interact with. And like a complex system, they are open and connected with external systems, some of which they can influence, some of which they cannot influence nor control, but they may be influenced too. And so you really have a self-organizing system within, you can find a team that may be more or less free to self-organize itself.
And in the book, you break it up into three regions, and I'm not sure if I'm getting this right, but I think it's about us people, human complexity, and then the complexity of the work itself. And then there's the organization and who we're interacting with. And so in the very first part of the book, you introduce us to three frameworks in particular from, is it Pellerin? How do I pronounce the name? Pellerin?
Joseph Pellerin. I hope my pronunciation is right.
Yeah. So you had the basic, the heat and flow. And in the basic one, you use this metaphor of control knobs. So how could you kind of turn up and down the complexity, I guess? And you had in the basic one, you had team boundaries and roles. Whereas in the heat one, it was more about getting the right temperature so you get the team in the right zone to deal with the complexity. And it was more to do with the volume of the work, the pressure as urgency, and the number of members in the team, I guess. Yeah. What are your thoughts on those? Looking back now, it's been well over a year since you wrote this in the book. So looking back now, how strongly do you associate yourself with those approaches, basic and heat?
Well, it helped me a lot to think about what's going on and understand it, but also it gives me tools to intervene in a self-organizing team. Think about a beautiful forest. Yesterday morning, there could be a beautiful sun, a lovely day, and today a firestorm. So a weather system is an example of a complex self-organizing system that can go either ways when it's left unattended. So having a self-organizing team doesn't mean that the team will be a great team. A team can be self-organizing and produce things that are not the one that we would hope to. So this leaves us with the question, how can we let a team self-organize and at the same time try to influence the team in a way that the team will achieve outcomes that are beneficial to us, but without breaking or hindering the self-organization? And that is where I introduced the concept of control knobs. Well, not all knobs are the same.
Dials, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Exactly, the dials are different. Changing the size of a team is a very direct intervention. Decide with the team how to split, what is the size, and you get it once you reach consensus with the team. But when instead you want, for example, to increase safety, or you want to align the challenges with the current skills of the team, well, you can try to do that, but those are all indirect interventions that may or may not achieve the type of change in the dials that you want to do. But even more, even if you achieve exactly what you were looking to do, changing the dials, doesn't mean that the result will be the one that you are going to expect. A complex system acts in a way that is not always the one that you expect. There are unintended consequences, secondary effects, and things that you can simply not predict. So you have to act in an experimental mode, trial and error, and you have to involve the whole team in this intervention. You cannot do that like an apprentice sorcerer trying to change all the dials at once and going crazy with that.
Yeah, indeed. There was a third model as well that Pellerin had as well, I believe, was the flow model. So in there, he also introduced the challenge level and the skills level. But there was a very nice metaphor here. Well, it was actually a graph that you had in the book about you could fall into anxiety if there's kind of, you know, there's too much going on, too much challenge level, maybe not enough skill as well. But also the boredom. So you might have very high skill, but there's not enough challenge. So you kind of staying in the flow zone in the middle, if you like, which I thought was interesting. Have you ever had some practical applications of that where you saw a really skilled team, but they just weren't getting challenged enough and they got a bit bored, frankly, and they didn't really go where they could have gone?
Yes, you end up being in a habit of doing things, so they come natural to you. You get used to that. You start to become complacent. You start not to notice things. So you have two effects. You kind of roll back into the routine and maybe into bureaucracy. And also you lose sight of what may be coming toward you. And that's pretty dangerous. This is where the team kind of solidifies itself and tend to lose the ability of changing and renewing itself. It is pretty common, a common dynamic. Think about the business models and products. There are times when a product is pretty well understood, standardized, and commoditized. And you start to act in a very standardized way, and that's good. In that situation, that is good. But as much as you gain in efficiency and you reduce cost, you also leave behind your focus on innovation and dealing with the unexpected.
Indeed. And further into the book, then, you talk about how can we assess complexity that's in front of us and what kind of practices you can use. And we leave the Kinevan stuff to Dave's episode, because he already had an episode on this podcast and people can check that out. So we don't need to go into that here. But you had a couple yourself, and one of them was sensing complexity and the other one was delivery initiative complexity assessment. Can you tell us a little bit more about those, Luca?
Yeah. Look, many people tend to work for a long time in similar environments. Some of those environments may have a lot of complexity. And so people that work in those environments for a long time tend to see all problems as complex. People that instead work in other environments with less complexity will develop a habit for it and will tend to see all problems as less complex. So it is very important that we stop for a second and ask ourselves, how much complexity are we facing with a certain problem or with some part of that problem? And you mentioned two techniques. One technique is very basic, and I use it to introduce the basic concept of complexity. Usually I introduce that model after a sprint that failed, and I see the team try to deal with that unexpected failure. And sometimes they can start to see that they cannot find a solution that may solve the problem that they are failing to fix again and again, sprint after sprint, and they don't find a consensus on which solution to adopt. And so this lack of certainty about what to do and this lack of consensus can be social signals that suggest that the team is dealing with a potentially complex problem. And I use this very basic tool to connect the basic emotions and social situation that the team is facing with the complexity of the problem. And I ask them, is because you are not getting along together that you don't find consensus? Is because you don't know the answer to that problem? Or is because the problem that is in front of you has a part in leading to this dynamic? And so through this reasoning, I started to raise awareness on the possibility that the complexity of the problem can have an impact on what they are doing and how well is that working or not.
And can you give us a basic idea of how they work, Luca? If someone was to pass by and see you doing this assessment, what would they notice?
Well, in this case, sensing complexity, that is the simplest one, they will notice that, for example, during a retrospective, when the team is struggling to solve a problem, someone may ask the team to rate the level of consensus that they are experiencing and the level of certainty in solving the problem. And then when, for example, they are dealing with very little consensus and very little certainty, this is an area where may indicate that they are dealing with high complexity problem.
Okay, so it's kind of based on the Stacey metrics in a way, is it? Kind of how well we understand the requirements, if you use that word, and how well we understand the technical challenges in front of us, I guess.
Yes. Stacey, it's worth noting that the Stacey matrix has been often misinterpreted. This is a very basic use of it and is connected to the social dynamics and is a good stepping stone to introduce the basic concept. And the use of the Stacey matrix, hence there, is a stepping stone to more advanced and accurate models.
Okay. And then if we move on to the delivery initiative complexity assessment, how does that work, Luca? What people notice?
Usually I use that, for example, it could be at the end of sprint planning or any form of agile release planning, where the team has spent some time reasoning on the feasibility of some work, on the size, on the feature, and on the solution that they need to create in order to fulfill a customer need. So at the end of this work, I usually ask the team to reflect back on the technology, on the domains, and on the people involved. And I ask them to think about previous experiences where all these things were extremely easy, obvious, straightforward, and other situations where instead they were extremely difficult, new, unexpected, unknown, and constantly changing. I start to mark those extremes, and then I try to ask them to rate where their current work, the one that they are planning, where is it placed. If it is near the straightforward, easy experience, or instead the very complex one. And with that, I help them to get the sense of how complex may be that piece of work. And again, this is an approximation, to be clear, because I'm doing that on a chunk of work. But yeah, we are talking about stepstones that help the team become aware of the more advanced concept of complexity.
So if I can have your permission, I'd like to read out some of the questions under each of those headings. Like, you've got domain, people, and technology. Under domain, how well is the domain known and understood by everybody? I'm just calling, I'm not reading every single word, but how much are the domain and the requirements volatile and are conflicting? And any other questions that may be relevant or may help the group? So basically, how well do we understand what we might be dealing with here in terms of business problems, if you like, organizational problems? Then under people, do we know each other? Have we worked together before? Have we adopted the current ways of working before? That's a really important question. Are we fully dedicated to this initiative? Or are we kind of doing other things? Often when I hear people saying, oh, I'm 50% on this, I say, yeah, which 50% am I getting? You know, sometimes it's 10%. And any other questions that may be relevant or may help the group? So they're kind of good questions on the people dynamics. And then technology, how much is the technology used known or unknown? How much of that knowledge is fragmented? How much is holistic and cross-functional? Do we have the experts in the team, or are they reachable outside the team? How much is the use of that technology novel or never tried before? And that actually reminds me of Tom Gilb's credibility variable, where I was doing one of his impact estimation tables the other day, and I was looking at some things that I have experience of doing, but I didn't have experience of doing them in that organization. So from a credibility point of view, yes, it has been done somewhere else before, but not in this organization. So out of 0 to 7 score of credibility, only had a score of 1 because they only ever did it in other organizations, not their organization. So similar, I think I see similarities there. And then any other questions that may be relevant or may help the group. And so essentially what you do is you kind of give the group or the team, if you like, kind of a continuum of low, medium, high complexity for domain, people, and technology. And they basically do some dot voting. And then I guess with skill facilitation, you figure out where they maybe are overall. And I'd like to ask you about that, because I've had some bad experiences with dot voting. I love when it's done blindly, you know, where we don't know what we're voting on, nobody can see. But I remember one time I was in a bank, and this guy, he went up to the board and he put his dots on the board, and he kind of looked around, and everybody understood that we were supposed to put our dots where his dots were, you know, kind of. But also I had problems as well where people were voting on things they didn't understand, which kind of sometimes... You could take a view as well, Luca, that with someone as skilled as yourself in complexity, you could just take a view on what the complexity is rather than doing this. So what was the benefit for you in the team actually doing this exercise, when you might actually have a better view, being someone who can actually read the compass, if you like? What was the purpose of kind of bringing them through that? What were you trying to get out of it, I guess?
Well, there is this interesting element of human complexity, that the complexity that we experience it as an individual and as a member of a team while we are doing the work. So there's no point in me, if I'm not part of the team, if I'm not the one doing the work, to say for me, this is a very complex or complicated or obvious piece of work, because I will not be the one doing the work. The point is to see the work through the eyes of those that are going to do that work. And when you see differences in opinion, that's actually a very good indicator. We don't find information when we all know that that's exactly the right answer, except that maybe we understand that we may have a blind corner there because we all think the same. But the most interesting part is when different people have different opinions, and then we openly discuss those differences and we see what one or the other may be missing, or what is behind that difference of opinion. Going to the point of the person pushing for a certain answer, well, there is a certain facilitation trick, is not to reveal the process up front, so that you will not allow people to reverse engineer the voting in order to bring people to the outcome that they want to achieve. And if the technology allows to have people vote independently. Something that I do to help people avoid following someone, even unconsciously, is to do the exercise individually on paper by themselves in silence, and only after put their opinion on a share of the board. So at least they can be aware that they have been influenced by others and not by their own judgment when they put their dot vote.
Thank you, Luca. And then in terms of practices for dealing with complexity as well, there was one approach that really caught my attention in the book. And I was like, these were like the gold nuggets. I'm always looking for little gold nuggets in a book. You know what I mean? There was a bit of gold here. And I'll just read one paragraph, if you don't mind. And it was about the C2 approach. All right. So the C2 approach space is based on the work of Dr. David S. Alberts on agility. This work has been carried out in NATO research groups and sponsored by the U.S. Department of Defense. The studies on agility have been validated by case studies and empirical experiments, and they have received the prestigious 2014 NATO Scientific Achievement Award. And then you've got quite a big section on this, and there's lots of visuals in there as well, kind of explaining how it works. But it kind of kicks off saying that there's five characteristics described in the work, one of them being the levels of interdependency inside and outside of the team, another one being the amount of information exceeding the time available, which might be similar to cognitive load, how much information is coming in that we can deal with, and is there overflow, if you like, and then uncertainty, of course, and fragmented and incomplete data. And I love these two points in particular, frequent interactions in a highly interconnected environment and frequent change. So can you tell us a bit more about this, Luca, the C2 approach, and how you discovered it and where you might have seen it in action and how maybe it helped you?
Well, this is the work of Dr. Alberts. It is one of the works that has been a theoretical model that has been tested with the empirical experiment more than others in a lot of different settings, military and commercial settings. So I found it very, very interesting. So Dr. Halbert found out that there are some characteristics that can help us identify the level of complexity of the work that we are dealing with. And the more the complex the work that we are dealing with, the more we need something in order to be successful with that. And he identified three elements: distribution of information. So the more the work is complex, the more we need to distribute information broadly. Let me make an example. Imagine that you are in a military mission with the UN, with the different nations, different teams and different nations. Imagine a situation where none of them talk together, agree the plan and coordinate the work. They will be in a kind of conflicted situation, try to do different things and even stepping on each other's toes. They may not even share information with each other, and they may not talk together in agreeing actions. And this will create a mess unless they are doing a very repetitive, well-rehearsed, and a very standardized type of action. But if they are dealing with the enemy during a battle in a situation that is hard to predict, then it's important that everyone has all the available information, that they can interact with each other directly and with everyone, and that the people that is involved in the action has the ability to take swift decision based on what they see in front of them. So David identified distribution of information, freedom of pattern of interaction, and allocation of a decision right to the group as three variables that we can use in order to align our approach to the complexity of the challenge that we are facing.
Yeah, that really struck me because you mentioned conflicted already, and then there was coordinated, then collaborative, and then edge. So I guess the more complexity it was, the more agility that you'd need, the more the decision-making would be, I'm not sure what the right word is, would it be federated or would it be distributed? I'm not sure, maybe distributed is the right word. So that was really interesting. I hadn't thought of there being an edge beyond collaborative before.
Well, it's quite interesting because actually Dr. Alberts not only identified those three variables that I mentioned before, but identified four structures that are aligned to different value of this variable: transparency of information, pattern of interaction, and allocation of decision right. And collaborative structure is the one that is more similar to agile teams, where you may have a team member that as a facilitator allow different teams of different people to talk together directly instead of being the man in the middle and put the right people in contact. And that's the collaborative approach. But there is also even more extreme approach where you don't even have facilitator, where the whole team have to deal with themselves and share everything with other teams and act in a very fluid and autonomous manner.
And later in the book as well, you talk about your own twist on the cone of uncertainty. So if you could try and build an audio picture here, where basically very early on in a piece of work, your estimates, if you like, if I use that word, your kind of sense of how much work there is for a particular initiative could be four times off, for example, very early stages. And the twist that you put in there was that it wasn't just about breaking down the work. You had that kind of, if you were halfway down the cone, you were kind of, you know, divide and conquer kind of thing. But actually, very early on, you actually had this twist of probe, collect data, and reevaluate, which I thought was really powerful.
So think about the type of work that we do. There are times where what we are doing is well known, well understood, and we have a lot of experience with it. And in that case, we can commit on what we are going to do, also predict fairly good way how long it's going to take or how much it's going to cost. And we can commit in one shot, maybe with the safety buffer. But think about the other extreme. When as explorer, as innovators, or as people working in a turbulent environment, we see things for the first time. We don't control everything, and we have to figure out things as we go because they are constantly changing. There is no point in trying to predict, forecast, or plan ahead. Instead, we have to probe, collect the data from those probes and reevaluate the situation, often doing multiple parallel probes. And this can have two effects. Sometimes through this probe, we can understand things, we can intervene things, and we can reduce the complexity and move a little closer where we can split and commit incrementally. Other times, instead, we have to keep walking in this very difficult environment with limited sight in front of us and continuously probe and choose and steer direction. So, like you say, identify the three different approaches that match to three different levels of complexity. Commit with the buffer, or split the work and commit incrementally, or probe, collect data and constantly reevaluate. And it's important for me to do that because sometimes, especially in larger organizations, you do a big upfront planning, and regardless of the complexity of the task that is given to you, you're asked to commit and to make forecast and then to be accountable of that commit, regardless of the nature of the challenge that you're facing.
Then in region 3 of the book, you make a reference to red teaming, which I gather is essentially giving people permission to basically offer dissent, essentially, to be disagree with whatever plans are there, which kind of begs the question then, you know, what do we need to do to kind of create the psychological safety where people can actually red team? What have you seen around that, Luca?
There are things about complexity that we human beings are perfectly wired to handle, and we handle successfully every day. Think about, for example, the complexity of a social situation, the ambiguity around that. And we are very good to handle that naturally because we are a human being. Think about our value system. I don't know, from the local church, from a political movement, or from your own profession. We have those values that are abstract, but then every day we have to do the incredible challenge to turn those abstract value into specific action, deal with the required exception, and so on. And sometimes we also have to deal with two of our value systems that seems and are effectively in conflict, but at the same time are equally good and right. And we handle these perfectly. Or thinks about mixed emotion. How many times with the daughter or the son or with the partner we can have mixed emotion, a positive and negative at the same time. And instead of choosing one or the other, that it would be wrong, we can look at both of those and come to the right determination of what's going on and what we should or would like to do. So there are things that come natural to us as a human to deal with complexity. And then there are things that instead are related to complexity and we are very bad at it. Think about our desire for certainty and control, or think about our desire for simple, coherent narrative and stories that explain events in a way that is understandable to us. And so we strive for that, going into leaderism, a myth of a genius and heroes and so on. And for all those type of things, we need a solid theory and we need a structure that allow us to go beyond what we naturally do. Going back to your question, finally, the red team is one of those things that allow us to express disagreement in a way that is safe, because there is a ritual, because I'm giving permission, for example, to you, John, to attack the idea. You are not coming to attack my ideas, but I'm giving you permission and I'm asking you, find the blind spot of my ideas, find the gaps, find the weak parts of what I'm telling, identify possible problems, bring your unique point of view and background to make me see my idea through your eyes so that I can improve it. And I also give a start time and an end time for this experience where you are challenging my idea. So inside this role that you enter into, through my permission and through the limitation of time, you can be strong, violent, and forward coming against my idea. And then when you leave that room, we are friends like before. And this way of ritualizing things that is not normal, natural, common, creates something that make possible what we naturally don't have for this situation.
Luca, we worked together before. We won't mention the company, but there's a quote that you said to me one day that I quote a lot now, but I don't say it's you. I just say someone told me this one day. And often as change agents, we're inside in a situation, and there's someone we're working with and they're complaining about something. And sometimes there's a genuine concern. And as you said, you know, sometimes there's a real wall there. It actually is a wall. And sometimes we think, they're just making a wall. They're just resisting. But actually sometimes there really is a wall. I've been borrowing that expression from you ever since. So that makes sense to me that in red teaming, that might actually come out as well. Yeah. Thank you, Luca, for that. Also in region 3 of your book, I noticed a reference to co-creation, which I talk about a lot, but there's an expression that really caught my attention. You also had co-evolution. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So ideas don't born in one day and one shot. Many things usually evolve over time, and a lot of things evolve together. Think about the history of animals and pets and human, how they evolved together. The human society, the pets, the religion, the relation between pets and animal, or farming. So what it happens is like when you are walking, you make one step. So one idea is evolving. And after you make these steps, the second idea is evolving after that. But this doesn't stop there. The first idea then take another step forward and evolve. And then the second idea take another step forward, like when you're walking with your feet. In software development and digital products development, often the understanding of the problem and the discovery of a solution co-evolve together. We start with the partial understanding of a problem. We feel free to draft a solution at that moment. We may try that solution and realize what works and what not. That gives us a better insight in what is the actual problem and allow us to draft a more refined solution. And the understanding of the problem and the refinement of the solution co-evolve. So you see, you have this co-creation where people work together, like when they do pair programming or stuff like that together. And then you have the co-evolution of ideas that co-evolve together. And those are two dynamics, social dynamics, that works very well to tackle complex problems.
Also, at the back of the book as well, there's something I really strongly agree with you on. You said, you know, let's not have any target operating model. Absolutely, right? There's so much of this A to B type stuff. We're going to do this, like, really?
No, spot on. That's an example of something that is not going to co-evolve.
Yeah, exactly. And you also talked about leaders being complexity aware. Yeah, I kind of say it in a different way, that you need to be able to read the complexity compass. And if you know, you need at least one person who can read it, so we know how to respond to that situation at least. But ideally, more and more of us would be aware of that. So that's why complexity would be one of the first things I talk to executives about. So hopefully people will check out this episode and Dave Snowden's episode as well earlier in the series. But there was something else that struck me that kind of gave me a double take, and I'd love you to kind of give us a bit more color on this. So you made a mention about no scaling and organic growth. So can you tell us more about that? Because, you know, the way there's so much pressure these days, grow, 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 scale, 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 give me, you know, now, you know. So where did that point come from about no scaling and organic growth?
Well, we often think about scaling processes, scaling structure, scaling teams. And in reality, what we want is to scale our ability to collaborate and to work together with others. When I start working in software development, when I started at the time, software development has been for a long time an individual sport. And then the size of the financial impact of software development, the complexity of software development made it a team sport. Nowadays, every work is a team sport, and we need to scale our ability to collaborate in team. But sometimes the products that we do and the work that we do may need to engage multiple teams. And so we need to scale our ability to collaborate, keeping everything simple. And I think that Ron Jeffrey quoted one of his friend and co-author in one of his books saying that if Agile is simple, a scaled version of Agile should be even simpler. And using the human ability to collaborate at scale, we should simplify the problem, the scale, not make processes and structure more complex.
Oh, so that's a
general idea.
I talk about descaling the kettle of, you know, the calcium deposits that kind of build up on the element. So when we're descaling, we're really talking about trying to remove all the gunk really from the organization, the slow processes, workflow systems, maybe even the organization design at some point will become a limiting factor as well. But these are things we need to simplify, refactor, declutter, aren't they?
Yeah. And you mentioned the organic growth. This is where the complexity thinking come into play. As I mentioned before, there are some elements that we human beings are naturally capable of to tackle complexity. So in those organizations, we just need to let human being be and tackle that complexity. And then there are other things related to complexity that we are very bad at, and we need theory and valid practice, solid practices to deal also with those methods, to tackle those elements of complexity to deal with that problem. And that's why I use the term organic growth to bring in the complexity thinking, the human element of complexity thinking in these.
Luca Minadel, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Extraordinary Podcast. Your book is available on LeanPub. It's called Living Complexity, Practical Applications of Human Complexity in Software and Digital Products Development. Is there anywhere else where people can find the book? Is LeanPub the main place to find it, Luca, or anywhere else where people can get the book?
Now is available also on Amazon in printed version or in Kindle version.
Very good. Very good. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Luca.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure to talk about these topics that I love with you.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you.